Trey Kirby from No Dunks joins us to discuss crotch chops and the NBA's youth movement, the dangers of cloning Tyronn Lue, and countering Taylor Swift with the Grateful Dead. All that and so much more coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. Things begin and things decay, but you got to find a way to be okay. And if you want to spend the day wondering what it's all about, go knock yourself out. John Gennaro, count me in!
1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
Today's first words belong to John Bryan from his song Knock Yourself Out off the soundtrack to the 2004 movie I Heart Huckabees. But the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things that I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and talk about it into this microphone and into that camera. Pretty good deal. Number two, that we now have two superstars out here throwing crotch chops in high-profile NBA games. Spoken before here and on No Cap Room about how much I appreciate Joel Embiid's commitment to the D-Generation X groin taunt. And on Friday, as the Wolves were blowing out the Suns en route to their sweep, Anthony Edwards busted it out too, and it was just as delightful, which means we now need a third hero to join this movement. Jalen Williams, J-Dub, I'm looking at you. And number three, as important as all of that, I get to spend part of my day catching up with one of the funniest, most creative, and flat-out best people on this basketball internet. My guest today is someone that I've been making jokes online with for nearly 20 years, which blows my mind. Well before I even knew his name, when he just existed in my brain as a guy named Goathair, who ran an NBA comedy blog called The Blowtorch, that when I was working a 9-to-5 desk job and trying to figure out how to do this as a living, it was basically my favorite thing in the universe. His jersey is in the rafters here at Yahoo Sports, as far as I'm concerned, for his tenure as the editor of Ball Don't Lie, the best basketball blog that ever existed. I'm maybe a little biased there. And the one after which this podcast feed is named. And these days, he is podcasting royalty, one of the co-hosts of No Dunks, the gold standard in daily NBA shows, which you can find on The Athletic and wherever you get podcasts like this. Friends, a warm welcome for Trey Kirby. Trey, thank you so much for making some time for us. How are you doing today?
Dan, I'm doing so good. Great to be able to talk to you for Ball Don't Lie. Very exciting. It feels like a full circle moment for the both of us. But man, 20 years, basically, we have known each other. Once upon a time, I think I drew a picture of you, what I thought you looked like, and mailed it to you.
And you like nailed it. It was unfortunate. The only thing that was different, I think, was that I didn't have a beard in your picture, but you were like brown hair, medium sized button down shirt and jeans. And I was like, this is actually staggeringly cool. $1, best $1 I ever spent. Until now, I guess I spent $1 to keep the onion alive. But outside of that $1, this $1, it's still in my, I still have it in my, here in my home. Cause what are you going to do? You're going to get rid of the artwork that Trey Kirby sent you? Never in a million years. Yes, full circle moment, worlds colliding, incredible stuff. And I'm so grateful that you're here today because I need some help to work through all of what's going on in this extremely busy first round of the 2024 NBA playoffs, where we are already three quarters of the way to having the Western semifinals all locked up. We might be only a few hours away from having half the Eastern bracket put together, and it feels like we're seeing a changing of the guard at the top of the league. So it's an interesting moment, and I could think of nobody I'd rather go through it all with than you. And we'll get into all that. But first, here on Divine Intervention, we always try to operate from a place of joy. So, Trey Kirby, what is something from the world of basketball that has brought you joy this week?
Something that's brought me joy this week, and I guess you would probably say the first week and a half of the playoffs. You sort of touched on it, Dan. The NBA youth movement is giving me life. I turned 40 this year. I'm feeling old. But the league is in good hands. Look at who we've got going in the playoffs right now. Number one, this could have been my entire joy piece. Anthony Edwards, 22 years old, looking like Michael Jordan. Nobody ever wants to say it, man. Everybody hedges their bets. They're like, I don't want to say it. I don't want to compare him to Michael Jordan. And then you watch what he does. You watch how he plays, you see the attitude he carries himself with, and it's irresistible to compare him to the greatest player of all time. The explosiveness, the takeover mentality. I think he scored 18 in the fourth quarter of game 4 against the Suns, went 6-for-7 from the field. And I'm pretty sure his one miss was a two-handed dunk before he finally threw down the other one, where people are going deep into the archives to pull out which Jordan dunk this really looked like. It's awesome. Like, to get a text message from my dad saying, MJ, Kobe, Ant, do you see it? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I would throw Dwayne Wade in there instead of Kobe. Nonetheless, it's exciting to be watching this guy play, to see him take the leap as a leader and as a player, I think is awesome. Then you got the Thunder, led by Jalen Williams, 23 years old, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, 25, Chet Holmgren, 21. And these guys look like steady vets right now. You got Jalen Williams hitting big shot after big shot and then showing up in the craziest hats you've ever seen. The Orlando Magic have Paolo Banchero and Franz Wagner, 21 and 22 years old, both putting up 30 plus points in must win games for the Magic. And then you got old man Jamal Murray, 27 years old, throwing down on LeBron, hitting two game winners. You look at his feet, and he's wearing a pair of brown New Balances. I don't know about brown basketball shoes, but the kids are all right, man. They're amazing right now. I saw that this is going to be the first playoffs since 2005 that we don't have LeBron, KD, or Steph Curry in the second round. I was a senior in college. I literally know what I was doing in 2005. My friend Jerry ran a fake marathon. He lived like 20 miles away from the school. So he said, I'm going to run from my house to school. We called it the Jerathon. It was a huge party. It got written up in our school newspaper. I'm like, great. I'm glad to have documentation so I actually know what was going on way back when. It's an exciting time in the NBA.
I'm excited to look back 20 years from now and say, like, I know what was going on when Ant was on his ascent and all these guys were coming up. I was podcasting with Trey Kirby. So really, it's not a Jerathon really, but we're all winning. Yeah, it's a Danathon and a different variety. I think the thing that's so interesting to me is that we wind up with these postmortems after teams lose, and happened after Phoenix loss, happened this morning, after the buzzer, basically, after the Lakers lost last night, and we'll get into that, where so much of it is focused on, like, well, what happens next for these titans of the game? And there's a way to look at that is like a somber, sad kind of thing, where it's like, well, we've watched these, you know, the entire narrative arc of these guys, and where do they go from here? What's left, really, at the end for them? And I don't feel that at all right now, because I'm so enraptured by, like, all of the limitless possibility ahead of all of these young guys. And that's, you know, before you even get into, you know, the John Morant story is still going to be, you know, resuming. Zion Williamson, it's a, you know, criminal that he wasn't able to get on the court this season, but he looked like he was ready to go. Victor Wembanyama is going to insert himself into this conversation before too long. You know, there's so much talent. There's so much youth. There's so much to be excited about. And the other stuff is fascinating and interesting, too, like where Kevin Durant goes from here, where LeBron James goes from here. All of that is fascinating, and we will talk about those things. But I think you're right. Like, it feels like a season of renewal for the league in a way that is like, and maybe you don't want to say necessarily overdue. Like, I don't want to say, like, we need to be pushing these older guys out, but it does feel like it's time. It is time for something that is sort of fresh and renewable and, you know, that has this big runway in front of it. And we're really starting to get it.
Yeah, it's an exciting time, and I'm with you. It doesn't feel like we need to be pushing out the prime generation, the incredible generation that we saw through the 2010s. It just feels like it is happening, and I'm interested to see how that generation of LeBron, Curry, Durant, that era of player relates to this current generation that's on the way up, because the previous generation wasn't great, I don't think, to the LeBron, Curry, and KD generation, slamming them for taking too many threes, switching teams too many times. But I wonder if that will have an influence on those guys going forward, because you already see, like, Anthony Edwards talking about how much he loved watching Kevin Durant go growing up. And then Kevin Durant saying on the flip side, that's my favorite guy to watch in the league right now. You got Jamal Murray saying, I wore LeBron's jersey when I was a kid. And now he's putting LeBron out of the playoffs. I have to think that the generation that is on the way out is going to be much more generous and kind to the current generation right now.
Yeah, and we'll transition in a second. But that I wonder if that winds up being, like, arguably the most influential player of our generations was Allen Iverson. And for a lot of reasons, right? In terms of gameplay, in terms of the style off the court, the way he sort of represented a much larger cultural figure. He's also like the guy from that generation, him and Garnett to a certain degree, where it's like from the jump, from immediately after he was out of the league, he was giving everybody flowers and making sure, like, not to speak down about the guys that are younger than him, the guys that are coming up behind him. He's always shown love to all these guys. You know, the you know, Derrick Rose's, John Morant's, whoever, the guys coming up behind him keep going. And I wonder if that's like a legacy point too. Like, that's, there's a couple of different roads you can take, and you can be a hater and you can say it was better back in my day and yada, yada, yada. Or you can be this appreciator of the game. And it does feel like so many more of these guys are in that more AI lane. And that would be, I think that would be a kind of cool rising tide lifts all boats thing to see these younger, this new generation of guys adopt that model as they move forward. Although we're still a long ways away from those guys needing to reflect, because they are very much in it now. And you mentioned Jamal Murray putting LeBron James out of the playoffs. 108-106 Nuggets win on Monday night. Another game that comes down to the final few seconds. Another tight game between these teams. Jamal Murray, second game winner of this series. Lakers gave it all they had, man. You know, Anthony Davis, monster first half, basically plays with one arm for the entire second half. After that collision with Michael Porter Jr., gives him a stinger, sends him to the floor. He basically wasn't moving his left arm, lifting it up for most of the second half. LeBron, 39-11 with four steals, one turnover in 44 minutes. They were plus three in his 44 minutes, which means minus five in the four that he sat. And again, like 21st season, about to be 40. He's still that kind of bellwether, which is nuts. Sprained his ankle on a hard drive for a layup. Just does the classic LeBron, I'm built out of titanium thing. Laces him up tighter, gets up, gets going. Another Ant does that as well. So, you know, maybe that aspect of the future is in good hands. Every starter in double figures, only eight turnovers, huge edge in free throw attempts, and it just still doesn't matter. What did you see from the way the Nuggets performed in that series and the way they wrapped up the series on Monday night?
The Nuggets throughout the playoffs last year, throughout their series with the Lakers this year, they are just such a complete team, because I don't feel like Denver played all that well in any of their games in the five-game gentleman sweep against LA. They certainly can get to a better level, because you see it in a third quarter when they score 40 points, or the last 5 minutes of a game when they go 9-for-10 on possessions, scoring every single time. But in that game last night, in game five, Michael Porter Jr. goes off in the third quarter, 4-for-5. He's making all kinds of shots. He's attacking closeouts rather than just settling for threes. He did throw an alley-oop through the ceiling to Aaron Gordon. But look, man, he's trying to pass. You got to give him some respect for that. You got KCP out there, sprained ankle, couldn't go in the first half, guts it out in the second half, making some big shots. They just get the kind of production they need further down the roster to carry a guy like Nikola Jokic, who has a 25-20-9 game. You're like, hey, he didn't play that well. That was one of the sloppier games he's played. He threw two outlet passes out of bounds. You know, it wasn't peak Jokic. It wasn't necessarily peak Murray until the fourth quarter, but they get exactly the kind of performances they need from everybody on the roster. Peyton Watson blocking shots, Christian Brown playing just a few minutes in the first half, bringing energy. They know who they are. They know what they need to do to win. And it's just very impressive that they have built this team together where the players are very good, but the synergy and the continuity between them makes them even better.
And it's maybe the wildest thing to watch in this matchup over the past couple of years, which goes down with, 12-1 record over the last 3 years in this series. It's absolutely wild. The team that has LeBron James on it is not the one that makes the extra one or two plays in the fun down the home stretch. Like, maybe no greater tribute to what Jokic has become and what that, you know, the cohesion of that five-man lineup has been over these last two seasons, then it's always the Nuggets making that last one play, that last two plays. Two huge offensive rebounds in the final couple minutes last night. One Jokic leads to gets a putback. One Aaron Gordon goes up over LeBron, resets it to Murray for the huge three that puts them up with under a minute left, puts them up two. And then, you know, the confidence, what they've built in that structure of games tied after two LeBron free throws with 26 seconds left. We don't need a timeout. We know exactly what we're going to do. We know exactly who's getting the ball. We're going to the bread and butter. It's Murray and Jokic in the two-man game. Flatten out to the side of the court, you know, empty out the right corner, and we are just going to attack. Torian Prince trying to, like, push Rui Hachimura up to help. Like, you got to get up to the nail. You got to get up. He's going to drive to his left, and he's going to pull up. You have to know what it's going to be. And you know what's coming, but the difference between, I guess, the good and the great is even when you know what's coming, you can't stop it. And they were not able to get those stops in the critical moments of the game. And the Nuggets are just, they're an execution machine down the stretch here. And I thought the it was from our friend Pickup Hoop on Twitter. The Lakers led for 165 minutes of the 240 minutes in the series, 69% of the total floor time, and they lost 4-1. It's maybe not, as you mentioned, maybe not the most impressive the Nuggets could have played in this series, but you are exactly what they are exactly what they need to be when it counts. And that's served them in good stead against the Lakers. I'm fascinated to find out how it's going to serve them going forward against Minnesota. I mean, that might be their toughest matchup in the league. There's been much made about Bruce Brown's comments last year that was the toughest series the Nuggets had on their way to the championship. This year's Wolves, obviously even better, bigger, stronger. You mentioned maybe not peak for Jamal Murray, Kazavius Caldwell-Pope and Reggie Jackson also playing through injuries, both left ankle sprains there, Jamal Murray, the calf strain. They do get 4 days off now before game one on Saturday. And I think if I'm reading the schedule right, there's also a 4-day break in the middle of the series between games 2 and 3, which kind of feels wild, but it could benefit Denver since they're dinged up and they've really leaned on that starting five. But very, very excited to see what that matchup turns into this time around.
Yeah, it kind of feels like a Western Conference Finals with how well Minnesota played in the first round. They were probably the most impressive team we've seen thus far in the first round, especially considering the way the season series went against the Suns. A lot of people were on the Suns. They beat Minnesota in that last game of the season. It seemed like, this could be the worst possible matchup for Minnesota. Instead, they just went out and completely smacked the Suns, and they're definitely the healthier team. Their only concern right now is that Chris Finch has a successful surgery and is able to be out there on the court. Like, that's their one injury, is their coach, which actually might be influential going forward, but it definitely feels like this is going to be an awesome series between these two teams. You had some Nuggets players last year saying that the Timberwolves gave them the hardest time in the playoffs. I don't know if I necessarily believe that, because it kind of felt like that was just Bruce Brown sticking a knife into the Lakers, because Jokic did say it was the Lakers. Sure. I don't know. I'm hyped to see Timberwolves versus Nuggets. And I just, back to LeBron, it's got to be such a weird thing for him to have a team finally own him. You mentioned 1-8 this season against the Denver Nuggets. That used to be LeBron against every Eastern Conference team. That was LeBron against the Bulls. That was LeBron against the Pacers, the Raptors, the Atlanta Hawks. There were a lot of teams that kept running into LeBron and could not get past them. And now LeBron is on the other side of it.
Going back to the Suns point, I was one of the people that was on the Suns, and I wrote our preview for it and picked Suns in 6. And I felt good about it, where I'm like, I could not have been more wrong. I was wrong like 100% maximum in the wrong direction. It was a sweep and it didn't even look competitive. And there were Wolves fans that were like, I'm pulling out the receipts. And I was like, this is good. I'm actually glad you're doing this. Like, it's nice that you get to do it. And all I get to do is go like, I was totally wrong. You guys are awesome. Great job. And then of course the ultimate thing of that disarming people where they're like, well, no, I want you to be a jerk about this. I want to rub your face in it. And I'm like, well, listen, if you don't know Dan Devine, nobody's rubbing his face in it more than Dan Devine. It's the Dan Devine promise. Nobody likes me less than me. Moving on, speaking of things that are dislikable, the Lakers now, you know, the Nuggets move on to that second round matchup. The Lakers move on to the offseason. And basically, as soon as the buzzer sounded, there were already reports about Darvin Ham's job security. You know, your colleagues at The Athletic, Shams Charania, Sam Amick, and Jovan Buha had it as Ham's tenure being, quote, in serious peril, with some stakeholders indicating it's highly unlikely he'll return. Similar notes from Dave McMenamin at ESPN, job very much in jeopardy. And Bill Plaschke at the LA Times wrote that the Lakers apparently want to start by changing the coach. So, it's very much in the air here. What is your general sense of how, whether he's back or not, whether he should be back or not, is he just sort of lining up to take the fall for a lot of other things going wrong? Or do you think that is the right sort of choice for them to make at this point?
I think both, honestly. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's probably the right choice. I don't think Darvin Ham made the best decisions for the Lakers this season. Just as simple as you went to the Western Conference Finals playing a gigantic lineup and then you change it going into the first games of the season.
Right.
That didn't make sense. Eventually, Reeves gets benched. Russell gets benched. Those are your two best perimeter players. So you're making things even harder on yourself. And then, you know, the speed with which all of these stories came out and how many of them there were. Yeah. We're going back to games against the Clippers where it sounds like the Lakers are having to make their own calls on what they're going to do going forward. It just doesn't necessarily feel like they are bought in to Darvin Ham. You're on Twitter all the time, just like the rest of us. You know, Lakers fans are ready to see Ham go. So I don't necessarily think that Darvin Ham was set up for success here. The roster, just not very deep. They pulled some guys from Hawks teams that were winning 40 games, and suddenly they're playing 30 minutes a night for them. Doesn't surprise me that it wasn't a great season for the Lakers, but somebody's got to take the fall, and it's going to be Darvin Ham, because he didn't elevate them to the level that they want to be at, even if he wasn't dealt this best hand.
Yeah, it does feel at this point like you are, and maybe it's always been the case. I know, Steve Kerr talked about that. We talk about that with players make the money that they make in part because you are the ones that have to take the fall or you might get traded, right? Like there is a downside risk to those deals you're signing. Lakers coaches, it's like you are going to get to coach the Los Angeles Lakers and get paid pretty handsomely to do it. You are also going to have the knives come out for you immediately. As soon as everything looks a little bit cloud cover in the sky, you are in serious danger. And you know, obviously the calls will come there, like depending on how the Clippers wind up the season. I'm sure everyone is already penciling in Tyronn Lue for that job, much as they were like, well, is Matt Ishbia going to throw a bag at Tyronn? Like, Tyronn Lue just needs to like clone himself, like Multiplicity, and then just wind up getting like every coaching job, because he's going to be the number one on everybody's list. Even which, by the way, his team is still in the playoffs and has not lost yet, and is, you know, 2-2 in their series and looking pretty good, and yet he's already being penciled in for every other coaching opening that might or might not open.
Yeah, you got to be careful, though. You know that if you make a copy of a copy, it's not nearly as sharp, Dan. So Ty Lue can only actually coach one team. It might still be the Clippers. After that, you're like, what coaches are really out there to bring back? Mike Budenholzer, he did win a title with the Bucks. They were a great regular season team, but they ran into roadblocks where he wasn't really making any changes going forward. So I think he's got a little bit of a stain on it there. Mike D'Antoni is an interesting name to me. That guy's got to be in his 70s at this point, but I would love to see him back in Phoenix getting these guys to run and gun. I don't know. You're totally right about the Lakers, though. You're guaranteed to get fired as a head coach if you coach the Los Angeles Lakers, but you might win a title before that happened. Frank Vogel, he won a title with the Lakers and got fired a couple of seasons later. So it does feel like we're going to have some big time jobs available this offseason.
And that's just one area that could wind up being a big point of intrigue for the Lakers. And then the roster, the list I've got here, I think 8 of their players on the roster are either on player options or about to hit unrestricted free agency. Headlined, obviously, by LeBron James. We're going to get to him in 1 second. I just want to say quickly, D'Angelo Russell is one of those players with a player option. And I absolutely loved this from Dave McMenamin's story at ESPN.com. Quote, "Hell of a year by D'Angelo," Russell said, humbly saying that. Just humbly saying that while doing the third person. It's D'Angelo, I've enjoyed very, very much D'Angelo Russell's, you know, rise, fall, rise again. Where I don't know where on the graph we are at this point, but him just being willing to say like, F it, I'm just going to kind of say what I think and be very humble in the process. I really enjoyed that. Biggest question.
D'Angelo has had some crazy quotes this season. The one where he's talked like, all this public humiliation made me the killer I am.
It's one of the best quote graphic sort of tweets that I've seen. And I don't know when you can find the perfect use for that, like when you've really just been ground down and then you can come back in a strong way. Like it's absolutely incredible. And also that like feels like writing from like a David Cronenberg movie or something like that. It's a very odd thing to be like, the public humiliation has formed me into the killer I am today. God bless D'Angelo Russell, wherever he winds up next, which may wind up being in Los Angeles. Biggest question for them, obviously, is will LeBron James be back? You know, our guy Vinny Goodwill was there last night in LA and they're in Denver, rather, excuse me. Our guy Vinny Goodwill was there. And when LeBron was asked if he's given thought to tonight being the last game he had played as a Laker, he said, I'm not going to answer that. Appreciate it. Which, very nice to say that you appreciate the question, being given the opportunity to answer it. He's got I think $51.4 million player option. He's apparently in the market for, and maybe has his eye on a 3-year, $184 million extension that he can get, something to that effect. About to turn 40 years old, but also, again, as we said, 39-11 in an elimination game, and you won his minutes. You lost in the 4 he sat. Where do you see LeBron's decision-making process going after this?
That's a great question, because there's also reporting from The Athletic that the Lakers are open to signing LeBron again and even drafting Bronny as a little bit of a carrot. Yeah, stick around with us. I know there was reports from ESPN during the season that the Warriors had approached the Lakers about possibly acquiring LeBron. They said, go talk to Rich Paul, see what he says. And Rich Paul said he wants to be a Laker. And I know the Lakers felt encouraged about that, that he's still tied in here. But that was before they lost to the same thing. I guess one positive for Lakers fans is that LeBron didn't threaten to retire this time around. He is going to be coming back. And my guess would be that he ends up on the Lakers again because they will pay him that gigantic contract. Is that the smartest thing? I don't know about that. But I do know that the Lakers like having the biggest stars in the league. And LeBron, even though he's going to be 40 years old during the next season, still one of the biggest guys out there.
Yeah, and that's, if nothing else, like whatever changes the Lakers as an organization have gone through over the years, that's always been the through line, right? Like we honor our stars. We take care of our stars. You know, the key example being, you know, Kobe Bryant after the Achilles rupture, they still extended him, right? And it was like, you know, even he's going into the sort of latter years of his career, they had no expectation he would be at that highest level, but he's ours and we treat him that way. LeBron obviously operates a little bit, occupies a different space in Laker history because he's not like a born and bred Laker, but did lead to a championship there. And you still want to be known as the organization that takes care of superstars and is the like the place that will respect them on the way out. And the way you show respect is with a 3-year, $184 million contract for an about to be 40-year-old. Nice work if you can get it. And yeah, Bronny James, you mentioned that issue. I think the Lakers at this point only have the 55th pick in the draft right now. Our draft analyst at Yahoo Sports, Kristen Peek, said if he stays in the draft, which he's entered both the draft and the transfer portal. So, you know, where Bronny winds up going.
I'm going somewhere,
baby. It's not going to be USC. And if he stays in the draft, yeah, the Lakers would be favored to take him. And as you mentioned, at The Athletic, the team sources say the Lakers are very open to the prospect of helping LeBron fulfill that dream. So they're going to have to keep an eye. That'll be a major thing to keep an eye on there. Where do they go with whatever draft equity they've got come, you know, the actual night of the draft? Is it a bunch of picks to go all in for one of your Atlanta Hawks backcourt guys, Trae Young or DeJounte Murray? You know, do we wind up with like the weird extra super team of Kevin Durant in LA with all those picks? You know, who knows? The story's probably only going to get weirder from there, but the Nuggets move on. The Lakers move on in a very different direction. Not moving on just yet, but we'll go through this one pretty quickly. The Celtics look like they're on their path to doing it. 102-88 win over the Heat in game 4. Boston now leads that series 3-1. Kind of the same story as it was in game 1 and game 3. Basically, if the Heat don't set a franchise record for 3-point makes, they're probably not going to be able to hang in this series. What stood out to you, if anything, from game 4 of Celtics Heat?
Well, I think the most consequential thing that happened was the Porzingis injury. That can actually have an effect on everything championship-wise going forward, depending on what his prognostication is and how long he might actually end up being out. Is it a week? He said feels good on Twitter, but who knows?
And, Giannis Antetokounmpo's already added the flexing muscle emoji. So we know that it's you know, he's really punctuated about being like, I am actually still strong, so don't worry about it.
Do you think in that situation you should go with the leg emoji? I mean, we know your arms are good, man.
I think it's more about like what better kind of connotes muscle strength. And if you just have a leg, like it's, I mean, although the thing is his legs don't look particularly strong anyway. So, but yeah, I think you're right. You're sending mixed messages here about what part of you is strong.
Yeah. But nonetheless, he's feeling strong and it seems like the Celtics will at least have a little bit of a rest before they end up starting their next series, whether it be the Cavs or the Magic. I actually think they could probably win either of those series without Porzingis, but that was the big thing to me, obviously. A guy who they brought in literally to be like their cheat code, their switch beater, who they can just throw it to in the post. Horford will be able to stretch the court the way that Porzingis does, but the switch beating isn't necessarily his strength this far into his career. As for actual game 4, you nailed it. If the Heat aren't hitting a franchise record in threes, they're going to have a tough time winning in this series. They hit 23 in the game 2 win. I think they've made 30 combined in the other 3 games that the Celtics have won. So the Celtics have done a much better job of challenging their 3-point shooters. You also aren't getting crazy shooting nights from Haywood Highsmith, Nikola Jokic, Jaime Jaquez, guys who aren't necessarily known as knockdown guys. When they're not hitting, it's just going to be tough for Miami to generate enough points to keep pace with a Boston team that can score really easily. Like, Derek White, you don't consider him a go-to guy for the Celtics. He's their role player, their glue guy who makes everything work. You probably think of him more so even on the defensive end, where he's one of the best shot blocking guards in the league. But man, 38 points, walking into three-pointers, no problem in the first half. He had two dunks in the second half of this game, and he was laughing after him. Even he was surprised that Derek White was throwing down like that. That was a great game from him, and you can see how important he's been to the Celtics, because when they just needed somebody to step up, needed somebody to take over, let's go to our fourth option, and he killed it.
The Heat made 9 three-pointers in game 4. Derek White made 8.
Like, it was crazy.
It's absolutely crazy. And I think, yeah, the only lingering intrigue there is, I guess, where do you fall on in the sort of pocket dimension of after the whistle blows, where do you fall on stepping into somebody's landing space?
I don't know. That was weird. I didn't know you could get a flagrant foul after the whistle. Yeah, it's been like, already blown.
Game off, right? Are we still, you know, how can we be flagrant when the game is not actually occurring?
Exactly. It feels like game off to me. But I guess the safer thing to do is just go KG mode and block it at the rim as it's coming down. That way You're probably not landing underneath somebody.
Yeah, Bam Adebayo trying to make sure that Jason Tatum couldn't get a shot off after the buzzer, after the whistle was blown. Steps in his landing spot. Jason Tatum, on the as he lands, rolls his left ankle a little bit. It leads to, I don't know, like 3 minutes of impassioned commentary from Stan Van Gundy about the legalities and, you know, the responsibilities and morality of putting up the shot after the buzzer, and how, I guess, Bam Adebayo should be allowed to play whatever defense he wants when the game is actually not, you know, currently going. It's a very odd set of circumstances in a game that really, I mean, didn't have much intrigue after the first few minutes besides that. So I guess we'll have to keep an eye on for how Boston responds in after whistle fracas possibilities in game 5. But I think
they already had their own run in earlier in the season when Joe Mazzulla was challenging shots from the sideline. They said, Joe, don't do that. It's ridiculous. And apparently they were right that I guess it could be a safety hazard. But yeah, Stan, I feel like, was just feeling himself. He's like, we got a blowout going on here. There's a 5-minute break in play. I'm just going to cook up some crazy takes, because he was basically saying, if you shoot the ball after the whistle has been blown, you might get fouled. You might get injured. That's just how it is. Deal with it.
It's purge rules. And I think really, you just got to protect yourself at all times. I mean, I think the thing we got to keep an eye out for is if Tatum goes up to Joe Mazzulla and says, I need you to come with me, we're going to go hurt somebody and you can't ask any questions about it. Does Joe Mazzulla just say, whose car are we taking? That's really what we need to see. You know, he's about that town life, and we got to see him actually live it, live his raps. As you mentioned, just one quick note and then we'll get out of this one. The Celtics should be pretty well positioned to handle a short absence for Kristaps Porzingis, if that's what it winds up being. They went 21-4 without Porzingis during the regular season. They outscored teams by nearly 11 points per 100 possessions with him off the floor. That's what Al Horford is there for. That's why they traded for Xavier Tillman at the sort of a little bit of insurance at the trade deadline. Obviously, neither one of those guys checks every box that Porzingis does, but it does give them some depth there. It's not ideal to be without Porzingis for any period of time, but if they need to bide some time for a round, when you're looking at a Cavs team that and or a Magic team, both of them have really struggled to score. And, you know, the Celtics are still one of the best defensive teams in the NBA. You feel pretty good about their chances of surviving that and moving forward. Also surviving and moving forward, the Oklahoma City Thunder, 97-89 win over the Pelicans, finishing off a 4-game sweep. You mentioned it earlier. Jalen Williams and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander slamming the door there. You really wind up seeing in that situation, even in a really like ugly rock fight of a game that was really, you know, super defensive oriented. This is why Oklahoma City's been this good all season long. Like, it's not just they've got an MVP candidate that can pop for 30 every night. It's when the game gets gross, they can still grind you down and win that kind of game. Not a ton to take away from where the Pelicans are at in the absence of Zion Williamson, I suppose. But what stood out to you from the way that the Thunder took care of business?
The Thunder are good. I mean, they weren't tested all that much in this first round with no Zion there for New Orleans, but the Thunder won the close game, right, in game 1 when it seemed like New Orleans may have been able to steal that one. And once that went Oklahoma City's way, the series kind of felt like it might be over. They had to absolutely have that one. New Orleans did, but OKC, they have so many options offensively, but the defense is so impressive. They're bringing in Aaron Wiggins. I guess he's maybe their eighth man. And this guy could start for so many teams. Such a good defensive player. Obviously, Lou Dort had Brandon Ingram in hell this entire series. Ingram coming in after missing quite a few games with a bone bruise, didn't have his burst. He doesn't have the strength really to push Dort around, and Dort just had him completely flustered, totally uncomfortable, and was never able to get untracked. It's impressive what the Thunder are able to do, the way they force turnovers, the way Chet is able to defend the rim, even though there will be times when it looks bad. Jonas Valanciunas will put him in the basket. He will bruise his chest. He will just ram as hard as he can. But Chet's right there. I think the Pelicans shot 9 for 35 at the rim when Chet was defending. He's incredible. This is this guy's first NBA season, technically his second, but his first season that he's playing. But between Shea, Jalen Williams, and Chet, what an incredible nucleus. They've got a great set of teams around them. They had one guy score in this series who's over 25 years old, and it was Kenrich Williams, 29 years old. Super impressive. Shea rolls his ankle in the first quarter. He's limping around a little bit, so he just plays the decoy, and Jalen Williams takes over in the fourth quarter. The guy's the best pull-up shooter in the league, shot over 50% this season, knocked down a couple of threes in this one, made some huge defensive plays, and then they get knockdown shooting from Josh Giddey, who shot 50% from three in this series, made three in the fourth quarter. Super impressive stuff to be able to close out the Pelicans on the road. And I thought the Pelicans played really hard. They just didn't necessarily have the guns to be able to hang with the Thunder, especially with all the turnovers.
Yeah, I mean, I would have loved to see this matchup with Zion Williamson available, because he was, and I talked about this last week with Sirot, I believe, or maybe on No Cap Room, who knows, I talk a lot. But I saw it where he's basically their only vehicle for break down the defense, collapse it, and then create. Like, you mentioned the difficulty that Brandon Ingram had. Like, I think he's going to be seeing Lu Dort in his nightmares. The NBA tracking has it as 11 for 33 shooting over the course of the series, only drew two shooting fouls on Dort, 28 points in more than 35 minutes of them lined up together, as many turnovers as assists. And I think that probably even might even undercount the impact that Dort had on that matchup. And then in the absence of Ingram not being able to get off and create for other people, CJ McCollum not able to do the same. I mean, we saw obviously in the late game situation, Cason Wallace putting the clamps on him. There's just wave after wave of these defensive options. The only physical mismatch that New Orleans was going to be able to bring to bear was Zion. Story winds up, unfortunately, I mean, we've arrived at the point differently than we had in years past, but we are at the same point of, man, if only they had Zion when it got, you know, in the biggest games that mattered, would have loved to see that. And then they have got to figure out sort of how they build the team moving forward. It's a really difficult set of circumstances, because I think everybody looks at the structure of it and says, the best version of this is Zion flanked with shooters, as opposed to Brandon Ingram flanked with shooters, or because we saw Brandon Ingram in that matchup get smoked this, you know, in the series. But also, you're going to try to trade Brandon Ingram now with his value. I would have to imagine that, like, it's absolute nadir. Like, how, you know, how they move forward, because they've still got some of, you know, they're still plus picks going back to the Anthony Davis and Jrue Holiday deals. They've got young players. They've got options here. They can't, I don't know if they can just necessarily run it back with this group. They've got some moves to make, but where they go and how you build out when you're still uncertain about how much you can rely on Zion late in the season, that's a tricky spot to be in.
I think they're definitely in a tricky spot right now. And the way things have gone for the Pelicans, you know that they need to make changes, because the past three seasons, they've ended up in the play-in tournament. Two times they got out of the play-in and then they lost in the first round. All of it without Zion. So it feels like Groundhog Day. Same thing, same thing, same thing. Something's going to change. I kind of think that was probably Brandon Ingram's last game as the Pelican, just because the fit doesn't seem perfect with Zion. He can be pretty good with Zion. He can definitely be good when Zion is out, though he wasn't against Dort. You just want somebody who's going to be reliably on the court and able to show up in big moments. I don't know if maybe the Atlanta Hawks are a trade destination for him, because they've got duplication with Trae Young and DeJounte Murray. I think Murray could be solid for the Pelicans, but they do have all these picks coming in the future. They do have young players who are talented. They just seem to me a little slow in this series against the Thunder. So I think they need to up their athleticism, and I think they just need to mix it up a little bit, because it feels like they've been running back the same team for a few years, hoping to hit the perfect mix where everybody's actually healthy. Everybody is able to play together and build that chemistry. And that just hasn't been the case these past three seasons.
And to put a pin in that, like, the thing that I was most interested in about the Pelicans heading into the season, I'd written about them as one of my most interesting teams before the start of training camp, or before the opening of the season, rather, was just like, we hadn't gotten, because of the health issues with Zion, because of sort of staggered injuries for their main guys, we hadn't gotten a consistent look at what it was like when Brandon Ingram, Zion Williamson, and CJ McCollum all got on the floor together for an extended period of time. We got it this season, and it wasn't that impressive, right? It just wasn't. You got the sense that this is never going to be a whole greater than the sum of its parts. They played 737 minutes together this season, which is, I think, maybe like five or six times as much as they had previous to this season over the first couple of years of them together. And they got outscored by 25 points in those 737 minutes. It wasn't clicking and not clicking and operating in the way that they wanted it to. You've got Trey Murphy there. You've got Herb Jones there. You've got, you know, if you want to see what Dyson Daniels looks like in a bigger role, there's more players there that sort of need room to grow and maybe a more harmonious kind of lineups that they could kind of get to. Whether Willie Green will be the guy to get them there, I think that's an interesting question. You know, depending on who you talk to, you know, you mentioned Pelicans or Lakers Twitter. Pelicans Twitter is a pretty frothy spot too when it comes to whether Willie Green is making the most out of what he's got or, you know, could be doing more with it. We'll see where David Griffin lands on that question moving forward. But, you know, they've got the Jonas Valanciunas question. Jose Alvarado and Najee Marshall are like important bench guys that are going to be hitting free agency too. Remains to be seen sort of where they go. And then the thing with the Pelicans too, or sorry, with the Thunder rather, interesting thing from them is like they now get an extended period of time because that's a 2-2 series with the Clippers and the Mavericks. And that's like a knockdown drag out. I don't have a whole big thought about rest versus rust, but you do wonder, like, for a young team, like, you do wonder if they kind of just want to get back going. Like, we got the jitters out of the way in the first one, and we've been cooking. Like, kind of, would they rather just go and get right into something quick?
Yeah, maybe they would, because I think at the very least, they're going to look rusty whenever the next series finally comes around. That could easily go 7 games, Clippers versus Mavericks, but both the Clippers and the Mavericks are better teams than New Orleans, and obviously much more experienced teams than New Orleans. So the series is going to be a lot harder for Oklahoma City regardless. So first quarter, I'm imagining it's going to be a little bit of a rude awakening. Oh, we're playing a real contending team here who are grownups, who are vets, who have played together in playoff games versus a Pelicans team that was happy to get out of the play-in, but obviously undermanned with Zion missing time. In general, though, I think you want the rest. Not let the Thunder are all that banged up, but it gives Shea's ankle a chance to get 100% before they go into a big time series.
And, you know, any extended period of time gives Mark Daigneau, our newly minted coach of the year, more of an opportunity to dig into the matchups, get into the lab a little bit. We know he's going to take a closer look at the potential opportunity or opposition, because he takes closer looks at everything. My guy's squinting constantly. So it was a pretty good sense of what's going to come for him. Last one, just, you know, we've got 3 games tonight on tap. The Sixers and Knicks. Knicks can close out in game 5 at Madison Square Garden. You've got the 2-2 series and the 4-5 matchup with the Cavaliers and Magic, where the Magic couldn't make a shot in 2 games and then absolutely blew the doors off of the Cavs. That series now moves back to Cleveland. And then in the late game, it's all East, but the late game in the Midwest, you got the Pacers could knock out the Bucks tonight. And it looks like you're not going to have Giannis or Damian Lillard, or at least there's some doubt about whether or not either of those guys is going to be available. Which one of those matchups is most intriguing to you as we head into this Tuesday night slate?
Well, I can't look past the pivotal game 5. Anytime there's a 2-2 series, even if it's the Cavaliers versus the Magic on True TV, that's important, you know? I'm thinking we're going to see the Cavs score over 100 points in this game. That'd be wild to see. But man, the marquee matchup, of course, I know you're going to be there. Sixers versus Knicks, a closeout game. Elimination games are tough to begin with. This has been a hard-fought series. Regardless, there is going to be some Joel Embiid shenanigans guaranteed tonight, Dan. I don't know who he's taking out, but it's going to be somebody. Will he get called for the fouls, for the flagrants? We shall see, but it is going to be rough and tumble, and I feel like the Knicks wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, I mean, it has been an extraordinarily physical and pretty brutal series from the opening tip. The Knicks have really won with physicality for most of these 4 games. And then also a little bit of help from the refs in game 2. The big issue is like what Joel Embiid are you getting? You know, he the reports out a shoot around this morning for the Sixers where he had missed it with migraines, which he had said earlier was one of the big sort of initial symptoms of the Bell's palsy that he's been playing through, which on top of the knee, on everything else, which, you know, like Joel Embiid is like Job in terms of, you know, the, you know, constantly getting your toughest battles in every playoff series. And then Kelly Oubre had to miss the shoot around this morning with an illness too. So, and he's been the primary point of attack defender on Brunson. The Knicks are just like almost out of guys. Like Mitchell Robinson wasn't able to play in game four. Bojan Bogdanovic already ruled out of game five. Just, you know, it's a war of attrition, and closing it out is going to be awfully difficult for the Knicks. So yeah, I will be there filing late into the night. We'll see where we go from there. But from right now, we're just going to go take a quick ad break, pay some bills, and we will be right back with the closing five. Welcome back to Divine Intervention. Guest here is Trey Kirby from No Dunks. And Trey, we're going to wrap up with something we call the closing five, because as I'm sure you know, how you start is not nearly as important as how you finish. Five questions for our illustrious guest. Question one. This one's a little bit heavy, so I'm going to get it out of the way up at the top. About 7 months ago, your co-host and our friend Tass Mellis got hit by a car, suffered serious injuries, wound up in the ICU. Very, very scary moment. He's recovered, thank God. He's made it back to the Classic Factory a couple months later. He's all good now. You could hear him on today's episode. But at that scary moment, you and J.E. Skeets and the gang set up a GoFundMe to support Tass's family during that difficult time and wound up raising more than $87,000. What was it like to watch it explode like that? And what does it say to you about the community that you guys have built with what started as the Basketball Jones eons ago and then through the Starters and now to No Dunks, this community that you guys have sort of created?
I guess that's a silver lining of the way things happened with Tass, because that was a scary moment. Getting calls from his wife and finally finding out what happened and seeing him in the hospital when he was at his worst, definitely scary stuff. But like I said, the silver lining of it was the GoFundMe. Raising that amount of money was really cool to see, but more important was like all of the comments we're seeing where people can chime in saying, "We're praying for you, Tass. We're pulling for you, Tass. I've been listening for 15 years," all that kind of stuff. It definitely showed us that we've built something that means a lot to people. We've been doing it for such a long time that I do feel like, you know, sometimes we get lost in the shuffle. We got LeBron James and JJ Redick coming out with podcasts now. You're like, how are we competing against these guys? But then you see something, you know, that's bigger than podcasting, which sounds like a ridiculous sentence that I just said, but nonetheless, you know, bigger than just being on the internet. It shows you that people cared about Tass first and foremost, and then definitely care about what we've been doing for our life's work, basically.
Yeah, it's very easy when you're making stuff every day to just be bogged down in the minutia of it. And like, you know, how do we make the next show? What's the next segment? What's the next thing you got to write, whatever. And then to zoom out, like you don't ever look behind you because you just have to do the next thing.
Absolutely.
And then
right.
To be able to look back and see how far you've walked and like how many people have made that walk with you. Like, obviously the most important thing about any of that was just Tass's health, but like seeing the spread of people in all walks of our line of work and in the NBA and in the broader sports world and whatever, just like stand up to be counted in that moment. It was like that. Yeah. That is a testament to what you guys have made over all this time and made me really happy to know you guys and to be, you know, in whatever connected way I've been with you guys along this journey.
It was very cool. It's like, I mean, you know, when you really think about it, we're all in competition with each other. We're all trying to be number one on the charts. But in moments like that, you're like, we're all in it together. And it was pretty, it was heartwarming.
Well, it's the way I remember talking about this with our old friend Eric Freeman a long time ago, where it's like there's the collaborative spirit of the competition where it's like, yeah, like we, yes, you are, you want your thing to be the best thing that went up that day. You want your, you know, whatever. But like, we're all kind of getting away with something here. And, you know, the more we get away with it together, the better. When getting away with it's getting harder and harder. Question number two, we'll move away from that. You, like me, are the parent of young children. What is the kid content that is hottest in the Kirby household at this moment?
Music-wise, it's the new Taylor Swift. Absolutely. Last year, my kids really found out about Taylor Swift. We went and saw the tour in a theater. They had their dance parties. And ever since then, it has been just a constant battle for me to not have Taylor Swift show up as my number one artist at the end of the season. You know, whether it be Apple Music or Spotify, it's going to rank your artists. And if Taylor Swift comes in number one for me, I'll know I've lost. So I'm battling back this year, but definitely she's getting some plays right now. I think the show they watch all the time is called like Glitter Force or Glitter Tech, some kind of nonsense on Netflix.
It's called Glitter Force.
Yeah, okay. You're right. I think it's Glitter Force and Glitch Tech. Two totally separate things. But I come down, I'm like, okay, this is a show.
What are you battling back with? What are you trying to make sure he stays up ahead of Taylor?
I think the Grateful Dead will be my number one artist. It's easy for them to come in tops because you play one Grateful Dead song and it counts for four Taylor Swift songs.
Right. It's a volume business. Yeah. You're banking on that. I respect that. Question number three. On No Dunks, you guys often talk about the pickup runs that you play in. You are very famously an adherent of the Brad Miller school of big men who pass and hit jumpers. To you, what is sweeter, dotting somebody's eye with a mid-range jumper or dropping a tasty dime?
That's a great question. I know I'm supposed to say a dime, but I feel good when I hit a jumper because I'm not a shooter. I can score, but I take a lot of layups because I'm a big guy. You know, I can shoot in the post, but a mid-range jumper, I feel very good about myself. Even more so than a three-pointer. I'm like, I'll practice a three-pointer. I got a basketball hoop outside. I'll shoot from far, but like a 15-footer feels like a throwback. As for throwing an assist, yeah, man, you feel great. There's no greater feeling than diming somebody up with an actually sick pass. But the rarity with which that happens, I would say that it feels more of a surprise to me.
Yeah, well, my 9-year-old is just sort of starting to learn how to play. And when we were talking about it, I was like, well, you know, maybe the best player in the world right now likes to say that an assist makes two people happy. And she was like, yeah, but when you make the shot, that's pretty good. I'm like, yeah, no, when you make the shot, that is pretty good. I can't argue with that. Just got to get your legs into it. You got to get the base under you, kiddo. That's what we got to focus on.
That's right.
Question number four. For more than a decade now, you mentioned, you know, maybe up to 15 years, broadcasting has been job one for you on TV with the Basketball Jones and the Starters and podcast form all along the way. And then now with No Dunks. I got to know you first as a writer, though, on your own site, on BDL, but also like music and pop culture stuff for like Passion of the Vice or Passion of the Weiss, rather, not Vice, Franz Wagner. Sneakers and fashion stuff and Complex, whatever. Do you miss writing like that?
I don't know if I still got it. I do. Yeah, I used to have takes about everything. Now all I do is watch basketball and listen to the Grateful Dead and occasionally Taylor Swift, apparently. Yeah, I do. I do miss, well, I don't know. I think the internet, when we were getting started, when we were doing our own thing, even at Ball Don't Lie, like, you can be silly. You know, you didn't necessarily have to have the deepest understanding. You didn't have to have deep sources. And I think that's changed a little bit right now. Things have certainly professionalized in the past 15 years to where I don't know if my skills necessarily hold up in that arena. But it's also been such a long time since I did it. But those were awesome times. The early blog days. On the very first date I ever went on with my wife, she said, "What's your dream job?" I was like, "I just want to make basketball jokes on the internet." And, you know, we've been married now for almost 16 years. And I've been making basketball jokes on the internet for basically the entire time. Sometimes it's writing. Sometimes it's talking. But it's a lot easier to just say what's on your mind than actually write it down into sentences that actually make sense, you know?
The incredible thing about that is that she didn't respond to that by being like, the check, can we just get out of here?
Now, what a sucker, huh?
Right. I'll always remember. I had went to a doctor's appointment with a new doctor. This is years ago, but a very stern, very professional Russian lady. And she looked at my file. She's like, "Basketball blogger?" And I was like, "Hey, why did I write that down as my job on a medical form?" But yes, I did. And she said, "This is job?" And I was like, "Well, yes. I mean, listen, no one that surprises me, lady, but you're absolutely right." Question number five, your approach to the NBA has always been about celebrating the most fun parts of it, the incredible athleticism and feats of strength and everything, sure, but also just the absurd nonsense that makes you laugh, that makes you, allows you to make little jokes on the internet. What do you find funniest about the NBA right now?
What do I find funniest about the NBA right now? Maybe the off-court fashions. Like, Jalen Williams, the guy shows up. I guess this was game three, was when he wore the bejeweled ski mask with just like a little porthole.
Yes.
With like an old-timey scuba diver. And then game four, he shows up in, I don't even know what you would call that hat, Dan. An inflatable trapper hat? I don't know.
It's like
these are terms that have never been said in any sort of way ever before. And it's hilarious. And the guy just goes, I mean, you know, game four, he sat the helmet next to him. But game three did a full press conference in a ski mask.
He sat the helmet next to him is not something I ever thought I would wind up. Yeah. I mean, we've come a long way from Kevin Durant wearing a backpack is, I guess, what I'm saying. Like,
yeah,
there's a lot of ground being covered. It's maybe a little bit of a shame that Kyle Kuzma didn't say yes to that Mavericks trade, because I would like to see what he'd be bringing to the game these days. But also, Jalen Williams, I love the idea. I know I opened up the door for him to be our next crotch chopper. He's got a lot of bits going now, though. There's the dog barking. There's the outfits. Maybe that would be one too many. A little bit of a inflatable hat on an inflatable hat. I don't know if that would be too much for him.
He would maybe try it, though. Hat on a hat sounds right up his alley. I'll toss you another one thing that I think is very funny. You mentioned quote graphics. You know, like, I feel like this has become a big meme genre in the NBA. You know, player says something, coach says something in an interview, and they take out that little bit, put it on a quote graphic, and then you see it for every sort of thing. I think those are hilarious. I think it's a great growth in the NBA memosphere. And the guy who is the best at it to me is Doc Rivers, because no matter what he says, if you put it on a quote graphic, it looks hilarious. You know?
Yeah, I always have to catch myself, because there's a version of these quote graphics that is like the Adam Silver, you know, get ready to learn blank buddy. And people will just insert their own joke there, right? Like an endlessly refillable template. With Doc, I always have to check, did he actually say it? Because like nine times out of 10, the thing that he said looks like a joke someone wrote for him. But it's not, yes. Like, he's like, yeah, I have no idea why they called me to take this job. you know, like, this is the hardest thing anyone's ever had to do. Like, you know, all of these sorts of things. You're like, is this somebody kidding? No, he really said that? Incredible. Speaking of Doc and incredible, just your general 30-second level of excitement for Clipped on FX.
Give me an 8. I'm going to absolutely watch it. I can't wait to see specifically like the basketball scenes of it. Like, because those look hilarious. You got somebody who looks like Rodney Stuckey playing Chris Paul. Jason Capono is apparently the guy for JJ Redick, or at least it looks like it. I thought they did a pretty solid job in the trailer. At least you're not seeing full things, but I'm like, man, that does kind of look like Jamal Crawford's jump shot. So yeah, I'm excited about this. I'm hoping that we get something as good from this as David Schwimmer constantly saying juice during the OJ ones.
I don't know. I don't know what I was expecting in the answer, but I guess I was not prepared for Rodney Stuckey. What, I mean, when am I ever? Whoever is fully prepared for Stuckey. The league wasn't. Neither are we. We move from the closing five to the actual thing we close with here on Divine Intervention, a weekly recommendation. Does not have to be about basketball. Can be about just something you think is cool and good that might make the lives of our listeners 1% better, or at least just worth them knowing about. Trey Kirby, do you have a weekly recommendation for the people?
I got one for you. It's 1960s spaghetti westerns.
Ooh.
In particularly those directed by Sergio Leone. The Dollars trilogy is famous. A Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More. And then finally, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And then his non-Dollars trilogy movie that's an absolute classic, Once Upon a Time in the West. I've been watching a lot of westerns. Laura, my wife, is like, you are literally my dad right now.
I was going to say,
I don't know what it happens, man. I told you I turned 40 this year and suddenly I like instantly got into westerns. But let me tell you, these things hold up. In particular, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Once Upon a Time in the West. Like, I probably hadn't watched these since I was a kid, watching with my dad and his dad. Like, literally, I can remember watching with my dad and grandpa. And now that I'm an old dad myself, I'm like, you got to see these westerns. But they're actually good. They're funnier than you remember. It's not just serious dour men the whole time. There's great interplay. Obviously, the visuals are awesome. The soundtracks are cool. The stories, like, you can't believe the way he brings it around in the end. So go watch a 70-year-old Western.
I absolutely love that. I mean, yeah, between that and just being like, yeah, I'm going to counteract Taylor Swift with the Grateful Dead. It's like, this is a strong pivot for you. I really like the direction you're going in. Mine is also a dad move here. It's maybe a little bit of a more recent one, but a dad move. Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, the 2022 movie, started, you know, as we were going back in a lot of this conversation to the blog era, started back in 2010 as a stop motion animated short created by a filmmaker named Dean Fleischer Camp and comedian Jenny Slate. Jenny Slate does the voice of a little shell that has one googly eye and little shoes. It's literally what it says, Marcel, a shell with shoes on. Sort of a documentary, a fake mockumentary in those shorts. And I remember liking those. I thought Jenny Slate was really funny and I thought they were cute. They wound up turning that into a couple of children's books. One called Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, Things About Me. Another one called Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, The Most Surprised I've Ever Been. And my kids really liked them. So then when I found out they were making a movie, like a full-on movie about it, I was like, oh, perfect. We do family movie night every weekend. This is like a thing I like, the thing that they like. We can dig into it together. I wonder what a 90-minute version of this premise would look like. And I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't quite expecting this. It was not what I expected in a pretty wonderful direction. Still that sort of fake documentary premise, mostly built around Jenny Slate's voice and the humor and watching like a little shell do stuff like I step in honey to climb up a wall, and it's all stop motion animated. It's very cute. But it's also this like bigger, richer story about family and loss and learning how to take care of yourself and about the difference between audience and community for a viral video thing, which is it's interesting in a lot of directions that I didn't expect. It's also really funny and it's got a huge heart. And we are a family of 41-year-olds, a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old, and it worked for all of us. So if you are any of those things or somewhere in between, maybe you would enjoy that as well. So Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, my vote for this week.
Excellent recommendation. I completely forgot that they made a movie about that. And I thought the web stuff was funny, the Saturday Night Live stuff. And look, they've had some success turning things that you wouldn't think would last for 90 minutes into something that's good. Like they made a Night at the Roxbury movie.
Yeah,
they made several Wayne's World movies. Superstar happened.
MacGruber. Yeah, right. There's a lot.
Oh, MacGruber, that's a good recommendation too.
We're going to make that a sub recommendation. Yeah. MacGruber. If you haven't watched it, or if you just haven't watched it in a little while, go back and watch that and go for a throat rip. Another recommendation, hardly any throat rips in the No Dunks podcast. Maybe one or two, depending on how Tass is feeling that day.
Yeah, we'll see.
It is, again, I said it at the beginning and I mean it with 100% of my heart, the gold standard for this stuff. It is the, you know, the bar we're all trying to reach, and it has been for years. And the Trey is such a huge part of it and has been for so many years, is a true delight for me. Trey, anywhere else you would like to point people on your way out the door?
Nah, that's the place to go. We are live on YouTube every day at 10 a.m. Eastern. And then that video show gets turned into a podcast on any podcast platform you could possibly think of, Podbean included.
Podbean especially.
That's one for my beanheads.
That's going to do it for this episode of Divine Intervention. Thank you so much to Trey Kirby for taking all this time to be with us. Thank you to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. Vinny Goodwill will be back tomorrow with a new episode of The Good Word. And Jake Fisher and I will be back on Thursday with No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed. So rate, review, subscribe, 5 stars, tell a friend, tell an enemy. Anything that you do helps grow the show. And I think that's about it. Thanks so much for listening, and take care of yourself. You deserve it.